Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. Egypt retaliates against Islamic State militants. Egyptian and Libyan warplanes carried out airstrikes early today against the Islamic State group in Libya in retaliation for the militants' beheading of 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians who were kidnapped in Libya. The murders were portrayed as retaliation against what an IS fighter described as the hostile Egyptian church. Coptic Christians make up about 10% of the Egyptian population. Danish police say they've detained two men suspected of helping a gunman who killed police killed Sunday in a shootout. They suspect he was responsible for killing two people in separate shootings in Copenhagen on Saturday. Lisa Bryant reports.
Flags flew at half staff in Copenhagen, and piles of flowers lay in front of the cultural club and the city's main synagogue where the shootings took place.
Democracy and also against the values we are.
Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo traveled to Copenhagen to express her solidarity with the city and its people. She and the city's mayor, Frank Jensen, vowed to defend free speech and democracy. Danish media have identified the suspected gunman in the Copenhagen attacks as 22-year-old Omar Abdelhamid El Hussein. Police shot him dead early Sunday outside an apartment building after he opened fire. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
For more on this story, visit our website at voanews.com. The Nigerian army says a town in Borno State seized by Boko Haram insurgents last month has been recaptured. It said the operation involved airstrikes and led to the capture of a number of insurgents, as well as truckloads of food and supplies. This is VOA News. A senior UN official says he sees hopeful signs of reconciliation starting to emerge in war-torn Central African Republic. Head of the Africa Bureau at the UN Development Program, Abdoulaye Mardie, tells VOA it is vital for the international community to maintain support for the country's transition toward a more stable democratic society. Lisa Schlein has this.
The UNDP's Africa Bureau chief has recently returned from a week-long visit to Central African Republic to assess what his and other UN agencies are doing to support the country's fragile peace process. He says great difficulties lie ahead for peace and reconciliation to take root as the population remains traumatized, deeply divided, and mistrustful of the state. Despite this, he says there is a sense of hope and collective willingness to revive the country's shattered communities and economy. The government is pinning its hopes for achieving a more stable, economically viable society on next month's peace-building Bangui Forum. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Leaders of India and Sri Lanka held wide-ranging talks Monday aimed at strengthening their strategic relationship, increasing trade, and resolving long-standing disputes between their countries. Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi.
Sri Lankan and Indian leaders sounded upbeat after holding talks Monday in New Delhi, noting that Sri Lankan President Maithripala Sirisena had made India his first stop abroad. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi called it a moment of unprecedented opportunity.
Our destinations are interlinked.
The Sri Lankan president's decision to make India his first stop out of the country is seen as a sign of his intention to put relations back on track as he seeks to rebalance his country's foreign policy. Mr. Modi is to visit Sri Lanka next month. Analysts say the challenge for Sri Lanka will be to balance ties between India and China, whose financing it will continue to need. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Indian Prime Minister and Sri Lanka's newly elected President Maithripala Sirisena signed an agreement on nuclear safety, hailed as an unprecedented opportunity. Ukraine's military says Russian-backed rebels are not complying with the ceasefire intended to end the fighting in eastern Ukraine and are stepping up attacks on a key railway town. The military said on Monday that the number of attacks on the town of Debaltseve has increased compared with previous days, with the rebels using all types of weapons. And the UN Security Council is demanding that Shiite Houthi rebels in Yemen restore the Sana'a government and immediately release U.S.-backed President Abed Rabo Mansour Hadi. Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
A rights group says government and opposition forces in South Sudan continue to recruit child soldiers, despite promises they would stop. Human Rights Watch says some of the boys are as young as 13.
That's Jody Kapawa reporting. Details coming up.
Also, the Nigerian army says a town in Borno State seized by Boko Haram insurgents last month has been recaptured.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Cameroon, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Libyan authorities have promised to continue attacking Islamic State targets after reportedly successful Egyptian-Libyan airstrikes early today. Analysts say while the Egyptian bombing was a reaction to the slaughter of 21 of its nationals, it could also signify what may be a larger change in Egypt's military policy. Heather Murdoch has more from Cairo.
Libyan Air Force Commander Saker al-Jarushi says combined Libyan-Egyptian attacks Monday hit Islamic State-controlled areas near oil fields and training camps and sent some fighters fleeing the country by boat. Analysts say Libya's campaign against Islamic State has been largely unsuccessful, and the militant group has steadily gained ground in the past year. But they say Egyptian support could turn the tide. Kamal Abdullah is a Libya specialist at the Al Ahram Center for Political and Strategic Studies in Egypt. He says Egypt's army is one of the most powerful in the region, but Monday's attacks were a reaction to the gruesome video released over the weekend, not a change in policy. In the video, 21 Egyptian Christians appeared to be slaughtered on a beach by Islamic State militants. After the video was released, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi promised to hit back, saying Egypt has the right to retaliate when and how it chooses. But Ziad A. Akel, a senior researcher also at Al Ahram Center, says the airstrikes could signal that Egypt's policy against Islamic State might be changing. In the past, he says, Egypt has supported the Libyan military mainly with training and capacity building.
I don't think that they will continue in that manner. I think that Egypt is about to rethink the pattern of its involvement within Libya. The real policy change, I think, is coming on the way.
The shift, he adds, is unlikely to mean Egyptian troops on the ground. However, he says Egypt has strong economic and security reasons to fight Islamic State.
The prioritization of the terrorism war would definitely overlap the economic dimension within this issue.
Analysts say millions of Egyptians work in Libya and many remain in the most dangerous parts of the country, even after Libyan authorities stopped issuing visas for Egyptians and Egyptian authorities told citizens in Libya to go home. Mr. Sisi has also been battling Islamists at home since he took power in 2013, some on political grounds, like the Muslim Brotherhood, others for their militancy, including jihadists in Sinai, allied with the Islamic State. Mr. Sisi's government conflates the two groups, and Akel says Egypt's current political climate is against any form of political Islam. However, supporting Libya's army against Islamic State also means choosing sides in Libya's larger conflict, says Abdullah.
في ليبيا ولا سوريا؟ هو طبعا خلينا نكون واقعيين في ليبيا مع الأسف.
He says Libya, with two rival governments claiming power, has never been more chaotic or dangerous. Egypt is working with the army that has the support of the internationally recognized parliament, a parliament that only supported the campaign against Islamic State after it was well underway.
ندين بكل شدة العدوان المصري صباح اليوم على مدينة درنة
Oud Abdel Sadek, a spokesman for the other parliament, condemns the Egyptian airstrikes, calling them an infringement on Libyan sovereignty. Sadek's parliament, based in the capital, Tripoli, supports some Islamist groups, but not Islamic State. And while it is not recognized by the international community, it still wields considerable power inside Libya. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
The Nigerian army says a town in Borno State seized by Boko Haram insurgents last month has been recaptured. The army said on its Twitter feed today that military operations to clear terrorists from Monguno and other communities were successful. It said the operation involved airstrikes and led to the capture of a number of insurgents, as well as truckloads of food and supplies meant for Boko Haram fighters in the town of Baga. The army did not say if the operation involved troops from Niger, Cameroon, or Chad. The three countries currently help Nigeria fight the Islamist extremist group. Boko Haram has launched attacks in all three countries over the past 2 weeks. The Nigerian army said the air and land operation is continuing with aggressive advance towards other designated communities and locations meant to be cleared. Monguno, a town of about 100,000, was seized by Boko Haram on January 25th. Rights group Amnesty International criticized the Nigerian army afterward, saying it had failed to protect the town despite receiving advance warning of any insurgent attack.
Meanwhile, the French news agency reports that the death toll has risen to 13 from a suicide bombing yesterday in the city of Dumatoro in Yobe State. Witnesses say a woman blew herself up at a crowded bus station. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack, but suspicion fell on Boko Haram, which has frequently attacked bus stations in the past. On Saturday, militants in the city of Gombe circulated a letter warning residents not to come out for the upcoming general elections.
The polls were originally scheduled for February 14th, but electoral officials postponed them 6 weeks, saying Boko Haram posed too big a security threat. The presidential and parliamentary polls are now set for March 28th, and officials have said they will not be postponed again.
Rights group says government and opposition forces in South Sudan continue to recruit child soldiers despite promises they would stop. Human Rights Watch says some of the boys are as young as 13. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Estimates of child soldiers in South Sudan range from the hundreds to the thousands. Human Rights Watch says recruiting child soldiers is a war crime when those children are younger than 15. It calls on both sides to issue clear orders barring recruitment of all children under 18. HRW researcher Sky Wheeler works in South Sudan.
We know for sure that both sides have recruited and used many, many children in this conflict, and we're very worried to see that this practice is continuing now in the town of Malakal.
Government forces are in control in Malakal in Upper Nile State.
What our research has shown is that over the Christmas period and in early January especially, there was a spike in recruitment in Malakal, and that included people who were underage children, including kids as young as 13. We spoke to many mothers whose kids had willingly gone off to join these forces, other kids who had been taken by force from Malakal town, but in several cases from right outside of the UN base.
Wheeler says about 20,000 civilians are still seeking refuge at that base.
We spoke to one mom who went over across the river to the barracks on the other side there and met with her kid and tried to persuade him to come home, and he said he wouldn't come home. And another mother who went over to try and get her kid back saw him actually being taken away on a boat together with lots of other children in an army boat.
The Human Rights Watch researcher says she spoke to a number of former child soldiers who were recruited to fight last year.
I spoke to one young guy recently. Last year he was 16 when he went to school one morning and was picked up together with dozens of other children, thrown in the back of a truck, driven for a day, and then forced to fight the next day for the first time in his life. I mean, these are quite extraordinary stories. I spoke to a couple of kids who have said that they were persuaded to join the opposition forces from the POC, the Protection of Civilians site in Bentiu, for example. Members of the opposition would enter the base, start talking with the kids, and persuade them to go and fight with them.
Wheeler says child soldier recruitment is widespread in the country. South Sudan's 2008 Child Act forbids the use of child soldiers. It sets a minimum age of 18 for either conscription or for voluntarily joining armed groups.
This conflict has really taken us back, many, many steps backwards in that process. The SDLA established a whole mechanism with officers whose job was to make sure that there were no children in any of the barracks. And actually, South Sudan, although it did still have child soldiers, had made quite considerable steps towards having a child-free army.
Another problem is that many schools have been taken over by armed groups. Wheeler says that's despite both sides agreeing last year that they would not do so, as well as recommitting themselves to not using child soldiers. The South Sudan government calls the Human Rights Watch report nonsense, saying it does not recruit child soldiers. It says HRW is using old reports and that its army has many recruits and does not need children. The opposition says since it signed an agreement last May not to recruit child soldiers, it has abided by that agreement. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Egyptian-Libyan airstrikes continue attacking Islamic State targets in Libya. The Nigerian army says a town in Borno State, seized by Boko Haram insurgents last month, has been recaptured. And a rights group says government and opposition forces in South Sudan continue to recruit child soldiers despite promises they would stop. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Liberia reports students began returning to school today. Schools have been closed in that country for 6 months due to the Ebola health crisis. More than 3,800 Liberians have died of Ebola in the past year, the highest number in three West African countries hit hardest by the epidemic. The Ministry of Education has ordered class size not to exceed 45 students. That's half the normal class size before the crisis. More than 5,000 hand-washing kits had been distributed to schools. Meanwhile, government auditors in Sierra Leone report there are no financial records for how more than $5 million in emergency Ebola funds has been spent. The audit was reported to Parliament. The amount represents about one-third of the total amount of funds used in the crisis in the country. A government statement issued today warns that those found guilty of misusing Ebola funds will face the full force of the law. The World Health Organization reports the number of new cases of Ebola infections in Liberia remains low. But Guinea reports a sharp increase of 65 new cases in 1 week, and Sierra Leone reports 76.
In Guinea, the government is trying to stem growing panic over false rumors that the Red Cross will begin administering an Ebola vaccine to school children. Parents have taken children out of school and angry youth have attacked health workers. Karim Kamara reports from Conakry.
The Guinean government says there are no plans for the Red Cross or anyone else to launch an Ebola vaccine campaign in schools. Health Minister Colonel Remy Lama told VOA the rumors are baseless and we are started by people who want to sabotage the fight against Ebola.
Il n'a jamais été question ni de pulvériser, ni de vacciner, dans une école. Et mieux,
he says the Red Cross could not be able to embark on a vaccination campaign on its own without the cooperation of the health ministry. He says any such campaign could be preceded by a large education and an awareness campaign because people are worried that they could catch Ebola through a vaccination. State television Saturday night showed a man accused by the authorities of spreading the false rumor. Police say the man will soon appear before a judge. The vaccination rumor has spread like wildfire in the past week. Parents scramble to collect their children from schools around the country. Schools in Kenya and Boke, large cities in the west of the country, were shut Wednesday and Thursday because of threats from students and parents. On Friday in Farana in Upper Guinea, hungry students attacked and destroyed a transit center of Ebola patients and set fire to a vehicle belonging to Doctors Without Borders. Two of its workers narrowly escaped lynching by the angry student. The health minister says the government is working hard to keep students safe from Ebola.
Le gouvernement a pris toutes les mesures qu'il faille pour pouvoir apporter un démenti à cette fausse rumeur par la sensibilisation.
Lama says the government is involving parents in an awareness campaign it has launched in schools to refute the rumor. He said the authorities are working to keep schools safe. Students must wash hands before classes, and foreign visitors have been banned from school grounds. He said today's students are more protected in schools than on the street and in their homes. The wave of panic reflects continued misinformation and resistance to Ebola interventions in Guinea, where this regional epidemic began more than a year ago. The Red Cross says members of its staff in Guinea are being attacked on average 10 times per month. Health authorities have reported such as a threefold increase in infection rate since January, which they blame on people refusing to cooperate with contact tracing. The government says it is working to eradicate Ebola by the end of February, the goal it set at the start of the year. Karim Kamara, VOA News, Conakry.
A pilot program in Rwanda could improve the performance of water pumps. The new technology will help communities and governments to repair water pumps even before they break down. The devices use real-time monitoring technology through sensors and cell phone data to expedite water pump maintenance. The faith-based nonprofit organization Living Water International announced the project. The technology was developed by Portland State University and Sweet Sense Incorporated. Mike Mantle is the CEO of Living Water International. He explained how the technology works.
It is a sensor. It's a piece of equipment that we affix to a hand pump, and it measures the water flow and the movement of the arm on the hand pump. And it uses cellular technology then to transfer that data via cell to a dashboard that then shows our operations and maintenance people when a water point is no longer functioning. Either the arm is not moving or the water is not flowing through the spout.
As it stands now, I understand that hand pump check-ins, that's what's being done now. So this is actually really going to help and save a lot of time for people.
That's exactly the idea. I mean, that's what we're testing. We're in a testing mode. So this is a research and development phase. We have about, at least the goal is 200 sensors. I think about 180 are currently installed. And the hypothesis is after you've installed the sensor and you have a operations and maintenance team standing by looking at a dashboard, they could see when a well fails for some reason. Based on the sensor, they pick up the phone, they confirm, you know, with a member of the local water committee. And then once it's confirmed that there's an issue, they jump in their truck and then they head out that way to fix it. Rather than, there's a couple other models. The one we're talking about is called the ambulance model. We're also in a parallel fashion looking at a circuit model, circuit rider model, and an ad hoc model. The circuit rider model is you train up a team of local repair folks, you know, alongside working with the government to identify and train these folks, and they ride a circuit. They just go visit village after village after village, and when they discover a broken water point, they fix it. And then we compare that with the ad hoc, where someone will pick up the phone, call the O&M team, and say, my water pump is broken. Can you help us fix it? And so what we're doing is we're comparing those three models, thinking that the very cool sensor will reduce our cost and increase our uptime. And that's what's exciting about this pilot.
What areas of Rwanda is the pilot program taking place?
It's in two areas, Ruhango, which is in the south central area, and Karungi, which is in the west area.
Who is ultimately responsible for the maintenance of the sensors? Is it the local community leaders?
The R&D period of the program. So Portland State University, working with their affiliate SweetSense, is responsible for running the research program, Portland State, and SweetSense manufactures the sensor. Living Water International is responsible for providing the operations and maintenance teams, working with the water points that we had previously installed in various community contexts. Each of the water points has a water committee that's responsible for overseeing the water point, collecting small tariffs from the users to put aside some resources for the eventual maintenance and repair of that well. The circuit riders and some additional trained people through the ambulance program are identified and trained by the government and us. And so it's really a collective effort during this R&D program with Portland State, SweetSense, Living Water, and the community members and the government.
As you have pointed out, this pilot program that is taking place in Rwanda is part of your large-scale effort to provide clean water to hundreds of millions of people who lack access to it.
Well, Living Water is a 25-year-old organization, and we have water wells that we've co-developed in 23 countries, 15 in Africa, and then Haiti, Central America, and South America, and India. And so we'll take our learnings from Rwanda, and we will take the best model going forward. We believe strongly that the technology around SweetSense is the most exciting and highest probability of increasing uptime and reducing our costs, and we'll just keep moving it with our partners to larger scale.
That was Mike Mantle, CEO of Living Water International. He spoke with me from Houston, Texas.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Africa, I'm James Butter here to remind you that February is Black History Month here in the United States. And starting February 1st, we will begin our Black History Month series and daily quiz. Listen every morning as we profile historical African-American and African individuals and events. You can win a special Daybreak Africa calendar and other VOA goodies by answering one of our daily Black History questions. Please send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us on 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. We will select a winner each morning from among the correct answers.
What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks. Get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. Cheers, cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah. Now there's a youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent
to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Egyptian-Libyan airstrikes continue attacking Islamic State targets in Libya. The Nigerian army says a town in Borno State seized by Boko Haram insurgents last month has been recaptured. And a rights group says government and opposition forces in South Sudan continue to recruit child soldiers despite promises they would stop. Coming up, we'll have music from Cameroon. And in our feature segment, our series on Black History Month, a time to recognize the history and achievements of African Americans. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand a Congolese giant is in line for a big basketball honor.
Kim Dikembe Mutombo is one of 12 finalists for entrance into the Basketball Hall of Fame in the eastern U.S. city of Springfield, Massachusetts. The Class of 2015 inductees will be announced April 6th. And enshrinement ceremonies will be in September. The 48-year-old Mutombo announced his retirement in 2009 after 18 seasons in the National Basketball Association. Dikembe was named to the NBA All-Star team 8 times, and 4 times he was selected as the league's Defensive Player of the Year. Mutombo was known for his rebounding and shot-blocking skills. After a successful block, Big Dikembe was known for taunting his opponents by waving his index finger, like a parent saying, "Don't do that," to a disobedient child. Off the court, Mutombo is a well-known humanitarian. He started the Dikembe Mutombo Foundation to improve conditions in his homeland, the Democratic Republic of Congo, in 1997. One of the foundation's big projects was the opening in 2007 of a nearly $30 million hospital in his birthplace of Kinshasa. After finding out he was a finalist for the Basketball Hall of Fame, Dikembe Mutombo said it hasn't been a solo journey, and he's been helped by various people along the way.
I think it's both. As a player, we don't see ourselves as just a basketball player. We see ourselves as a human being. And there's so many people that come to our way of life to make sure that we succeed. So we make sure that we balance our life with off the court and off the court. So I'm very happy to be here. And sitting around all the great guys I see, from Willis Reed, Dominique, Moses Malone, and Alonzo Mourning, and all those guys, I don't know how to express myself today.
Dikembe Mutombo spoke in New York City, where he attended Sunday night's annual NBA All-Star Game at Madison Square Garden. In fact, Dikembe had some special company at the popular exhibition contest. He sat courtside next to former U.S. President Bill Clinton. The Western Conference All-Stars beat the Eastern Conference All-Stars 163-158. Oklahoma City Thunder guard Russell Westbrook scored a game-high 41 points and was named the game's most valuable player.
It's definitely a blessing, man. You never want to take no games for granted, especially an All-Star game, to get a chance to go out and show your talents, man. And I'm just blessed to be able to play the game that I love, and I'm definitely happy we got the win.
Happy to get the win. That's Russell Westbrook of the Oklahoma City Thunder, the most valuable player of the 2015 NBA All-Star Game.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
This is Dikembe Mutombo,
I am from Africa. Malaria kills thousands of children every day. Don't let your child be one of them. Make sure they sleep under a treated mosquito net. Beating malaria is like winning at basketball. You need to get to the net.
Just ahead on the Sunny Side of Sports, my VOA colleague James Buddy will have a Black History Month segment on a basketball great and a boxing great.
On this day in 1970, Joe Frazier became world heavyweight boxing champion after knocking out Jimmy Ellis in the second round at Madison Square Garden in New York City. On this day in 1972, during a basketball game between the Los Angeles Lakers and the Phoenix Suns, Wilt Chamberlain became the first man in the history of the NBA to score 30,000 points.
I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. The VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Shagun Dot on the Spot Adeyemi, joins us now with some reaction to the recent Africa Cup of Nations football tournament, as well as other sports news.
Good evening, Africa. The 2015 Africa Cup of Nations has come and gone, but the fallouts of Africa's premier football tournament continue to reverberate. First, the sanctions imposed on Morocco for withdrawing as the original host due to Ebola fears. African soccer's governing body, CAF, banned the North African country from the next two editions of the tournaments in 2017 and 2019. The Royal Moroccan Football Federation, FRMF, was also fined $1 million. In order to pay another $9.12 million in damages to CAF and its partners. After Morocco's withdrawal in November 2014, Equatorial Guinea came on as emergency hosts, saving the tournament. Well, Morocco has rejected all the sanctions, saying there is no regulatory basis for the punishments. The Moroccan Federation said it will, quote, take all necessary measures to uphold the rights and interests of Moroccan football and provisions, unquote. But are the sanctions against Morocco strong enough to prevent future host nations from behaving like the North African country? That was the question I put to Segun Aribike, a former editor-in-chief of the News Agency of Nigeria and a football enthusiast.
Yes, I think so. $1 million, close to $1 million, and then another $9 million for as reparation, as it were, is it? Imagine what would have happened, what disgrace Africa would have faced if Equatorial Guinea didn't come to CAF's aid. So I think going by that, the sanctions are okay. Let Morocco stay out of the championship for two times, and then that will serve as a deterrent. I believe other nations won't do that.
How do you see the tournament in Equatorial Guinea, considering that Equatorial Guinea had to be an emergency host?
I think they did their best, given the short time they had to prepare. Initially, there were complaints about inadequate hotel rooms, inadequate transportation, but as the tournament wore on, all those problems were forgotten, and people concentrated on the football. And I think Equatorial Guinea deserves the commendation for preventing this shame to Africa.
That was Segun Aribike, a former editor-in-chief of the News Agency of Nigeria. He spoke with me right here in Lagos. In more fallout from the 2015 Nations Cup, Equatorial Guinea President Teodoro Obiang Nguema Mbasogo has pardoned 149 people who were arrested following clashes during the Africa Cup of Nations semifinal between the host nation and Ghana. Martin Gundongu Sue, president of Malabo Supreme Court, confirmed on Friday that all those arrested have been released. "We were ready to go to trial for you to be punished, but the president of the republic, Teodoro Obiang, in his role as the chief magistrate of the nation and father of all of you, has forgiven you and you are free," Ndongu Sue told the accused before they were released to their families in front of the Supreme Court. President Mbasogo had blasted what he called the childish behavior of Equatorial Guinea fans who turned on Ghanaian supporters, pelting them with plastic bottles and chairs and leaving 36 injured. The 2015 Nations Cup host was fined $100,000 by CAF and ordered to play a match behind closed doors. In other news, World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, doesn't like the choice of Manaus as a football host city for the 2016 Olympics in Brazil. FIFA says it prefers games to be played at venues closer to Game Center in Rio de Janeiro and that Manaus is not a suitable first option for a hosting venue. FIFA's statement came a day after the Olympic organizers announced that they were adding Manaus to the list of proposed host cities to integrate all of Brazil into the games. The city is about 3,000 kilometers from Rio in the Amazon jungle. The other proposed venues beside Rio are Sao Paulo, Belo Horizonte, Salvador, and Brasilia. All of them hosted matches during last year's World Cup.
I'm Manny Pacquiao, the fighter from the Philippines.
Listen, when you're talking about the best fighter, you're talking about Floyd Mayweather.
Has the richest matchup in boxing history between Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao been finally agreed? The answer depends on whom you believe. The London Telegraph newspaper reported on Sunday that the Filipino boxer completed his contractual agreements on Saturday and that Mayweather is set to sign in the coming days. Manny has 100% signed his side of the deal, the paper reported. It is now over to Mayweather to close the deal and announce the fight. But Showtime Sports boxing executive Steven Espinosa says no deal has been signed. Not sure what anyone is signing since no agreement has been finalized yet, Espinosa said on his Twitter account. The mega fights between the pair of welterweight world champions is expected to shatter all box office records. Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Thanks, Segun. And I have my fingers crossed that the Floyd Mayweather-Manny Pacquiao boxing blockbuster gets finalized soon. Get in the ring, guys. Come on. We want to see you guys go at it. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, our series on Black History Month, a time to recognize the history and achievements of African Americans. And next, we focus on the severely understaffed healthcare system in Uganda. But first, some music. Here is Deborah Debs of Cameroon with Africa Higher Higher. Deborah Debs of Cameroon with Africa, Higher, Higher.
Well, February is Black History Month in the U.S. We continue our series this week looking at the achievements of African Americans. Today we take a look at Rosa Parks, a Black woman who made U.S. history and newspaper headlines when she refused to give up her seat on a public bus in Montgomery, Alabama, to white passengers 60 years ago. Documents held by the U.S. Library of Congress shed new light on the life of the African-American woman who became a renowned civil rights activist in the civil disobedience that led to the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Salem Solomon has more on Parks' personal notes.
I didn't move because I didn't feel like it was helping us or making things lighter for us, me as an individual and us as a people, to continue to be pushed around because of our race and color.
Rosa Parks is best remembered for that day 60 years ago for a quiet act of defiance on an Alabama bus. But that moment, which sparked a bus boycott and fueled a national movement led by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., is not all that defined her. Archival documents released for the first time by the U.S. Library of Congress show a woman who survived a difficult childhood, deserted by her father when she was 2.5 years old, lost a husband, and struggled for years with feelings of anger over her treatment at the hands of white segregationists. The documents were released on February 4th to commemorate Rosa Parks Day, the 102nd anniversary of her birth in 1913. Parks debated how much of herself to reveal in a handwritten sketch of her life on display in the archives. She asked in her personal notes if it was worthwhile to reveal intimate information from her past. Would the public be sympathetic or disillusioned when they learned the facts about her life? Would the results harm or support the civil rights movement? Adrienne Cannon is a specialist in African American history and culture at the Library of Congress. She says it is valuable to see a towering historical figure like Parks in three dimensions and in all her complexity.
So she's very much aware of her public persona, of what she thinks is expected of her from society. And she's wrestling with, I think, a personal need, as I think we all have, to reveal our true selves.
The archives include 7,500 manuscripts and 2,500 photographs that Parks accumulated throughout her life. She wrote and collected letters from admirers until her death at age 92. Some of her earliest recollections are from a violent period in Alabama when her grandfather would stay up all night guarding the home with a shotgun in case a member of white supremacist group, the Ku Klux Klan, tried to attack it. In her personal notes, she declared that the first to invade their home would surely die. She also articulates the injustice she felt in the era of Jim Crow laws where restrooms, lunch counters, and other public places were segregated. VOA's Carol Van Dam reads excerpts from Parks' notes.
It is not easy to remain rational and normal mentally in such a setting where even in our airport in Montgomery, there is a white waiting room, none for colored except an unmarked seat in the entrance. There are restroom facilities for white ladies and colored women, white men and colored men. We stand outside after being served at the same ticket counter instead of sitting on the inside.
Her notes are particularly strong after she was arrested for refusing to give up her seat. Again, VOA's Van Dam reads excerpts from Parks' notes.
I am nothing. I belong nowhere and to no one. There is just so much hurt, disappointment, and oppression one can take. The bubble of life grows larger. The line between reason and madness grows thinner.
Marcia Battle, curator at Library of Congress in the Print and Photographs Division, said it's important to release this information even if it contradicts the public image of Parks as a stoic protester.
And I think what happens is we get her frozen in that particular time point. We get her frozen as the woman, and that's all she did. But here in this collection, what we're finding out is that she was more than that, and it started very early on.
Battle says the public should know that her fight for justice began early in her life and continued through the bus boycott to the end of her life in 2005 at age 92. For VOA, I'm Salem Solomon, Washington, D.C.
Uganda's Ministry of Foreign Affairs will send nearly 300 highly skilled healthcare workers to Trinidad and Tobago. Critics say health facilities are already severely understaffed and that more than a million Ugandans will lose their health care provider because of the move. Elizabeth Pollard reports from Kampala, Uganda.
For years, Uganda has suffered from a severe lack of health care workers. Low recruitment combined with irregular pay and under-equipped facilities have resulted in many workers seeking employment in other fields or moving abroad. The government is now facilitating this process by shortlisting 283 highly skilled health workers to be sent to Trinidad and Tobago for work. Program officials say among them are 185 midwives, 20 of the nation's 28 radiologists, and one of only three of the nation's neurosurgeons. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs is hoping that the program will result in remittances sent home, which will be taxed by the government and will help raise funding for the healthcare sector. Uganda has about one doctor for every 25,000 patients and one nurse for every 11,000 patients. Such numbers have resulted in scores of preventable deaths and high maternal mortality rates, with 17 women dying each day due to labor complications. Janet Obuni, president of the Uganda Nurses and Midwives Union, says work abroad programs are attractive because it's common for nurses to go unpaid for up to 6 months at a time. Yet she says sending workers abroad will put many patients in danger.
We find it very unfortunate that the government would take a decision to export its health workers to, as you said, a very small country that is very rich and that has even more health workers for its population. I know the government is trying to fix the issue of not paying health workers well by sending them out so that the health workers can be settled, because out there they'll earn more money. What about the population here?
However, Fred Opelot, the spokesman for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, says the government is monitoring the process closely.
The Ministry of Foreign Affairs is working very closely with the Ministry of Health and indeed Ministry of Labor and Gender. They've also ensured that whatever they do, they do not put the country in a situation where it will endanger the lives of Ugandans. This is a well-thought-out initiative, and they're confident that by sending a few health workers to Trinidad and Tobago, it will not constrain the health system in Uganda.
A local think tank called the Institute for Public Policy and Research has filed suit with the High Court for what it calls government-assisted brain drain. The hearing is expected to take place on March 2nd. Elizabeth Pola, VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yates Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Greg Burns, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Nigeria's Election Commission has postponed the nation's closely watched presidential election for 6 weeks, citing security concerns over the insurgent group Boko Haram's continued attacks in areas of northeast Nigeria. Once set for February 14th, voting will now be held March 28th, as combined operations of troops from Chad, Cameroon, and Nigeria work to reclaim and pacify areas of the country taken over by the insurgents, bent on creating an Islamic State. Despite security concerns, the move brought charges of political interference by the government and sparked fears of political unrest in the hotly contested race. Opposition leaders have called for calm to discourage the kind of violence that marred the voting in 2011. The United States joins others in the international community in voicing deep disappointment in the Election Commission's decision to postpone the election. Any political interference with the Independent National Electoral Commission is unacceptable, and it is critical that the government not use security concerns as a pretext for impeding the democratic process. Given the stakes, it's absolutely critical that these elections be conducted peacefully and that they are credible, transparent, and accountable. That way, the people of Nigeria can have faith, and the world can have faith in the government that flows from it. The international community will be watching closely as the Nigerian government prepares for elections on the newly scheduled dates. The United States underscores the importance of ensuring that there are no further delays. We support a free, transparent, and credible electoral process in Nigeria and renew our calls on all candidates, their supporters, and Nigerian citizens to maintain calm and reject election-related violence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
next on Let's Talk. Join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing dress code. This light-hearted show discusses topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.